Good morning and welcome to Sport and Luck with Sam Kekovich and Leon Wigard. Sam, now, Northern Territory, are they going to come in or are they going to be called the Crocs?
Oh, what about that? Now, look, you can argue very strongly why they should be in to make it a truly national competition. They've been mooted for some time, that the amount of talent, there's a wealth of talent up there. There's no doubt about that. But what surprises me, Leon, they put it together a steering committee comprising of Nathan Buckley.
Demetrio.
And who was this?
Andrew McLeod.
Now, that's okay. I've got nothing against them. They've got two football minds. Andrew Demetrio is a part of the you know, it just seems strange that all of a sudden there'd be a little junket that they're putting collating. Surely they'd have enough evidence compiled by now and data.
Oh, it's all about appearances.
It's all lip service. It's just futile. It's a waste of money. They should have all the data comprised over many, many moons now. We've been playing games in Darwin now for, 20 years, the odd game. Now, whether it's feasible or not, they should certainly be aware of it. But there's no doubt that there should be a side out of Darwin. How it'd be initially be comprised, I'm not so sure. Whether it be a standalone side or whether they would need some assistance in that regard. But look, from a talent perspective, you'd say yes, it's a tick on all fronts. More importantly, if I may just digress for a moment, Leon.
Yes, please do.
I woke up the other day jumping out of my skin.
Why?
Well, jumping being the operative word.
Ah.
As you know, you and I.
We're going back to the bull.
We're back to the bull. As you and I are proud owners of a little speck or a little...
Part owners. Minuscule part owners.
Well, okay, it's irrelevant how much we've got, but we're certainly a part of the consortium.
What are the share costs,
I'm telling you once again, that's Dan who interrupted. Yeah. Dan, who's the producer. I've told him 100 times to butt out and stick to your terms of reference.
And that's telling you this morning.
Producing the show. We're the talent. Now, our little... Neddy calls Stern Idol.
Well,
he's a monster.
Giant.
But he did produce one of those stellar performances,
yeah,
which they'll be talking about in the next 100 years, winning the Brierley Steeple, carrying 73 kg.
Carried the Town Hall.
And the Town Hall, Leon, 8 kilos more than the runner-up. And he looked beaten at the 100, but he dug deep in the true spirit of its owners. They just head down, tail up, and just...
We're going to change the name to the Kangaroo.
The Kangaroo.
Well, yeah, that fighting spirit.
Well, and the shin boner, you're right. Yeah, digging deep.
The shin boner, you're bringing it back there.
Yeah, the shin boners. And what a great thrill it was.
It was, yeah.
So that's Stellar Idol, a little horse.
Stern Idol, yeah.
Stern Idol, I mean, we with our great friend Jerry Ryan, who's the boss of the consortium and a host of others, they're nondescript by comparison to you and I, lad. Oh, Frank Sedgwin's got a... People would know who Frank Sedgwin is, certainly. But we hold the bulk of the movement, and it was a great thrill. So, yes. But before we go on too much talking about ourselves and what we've got and what we've acquired and what we intend doing, by the way, is your – I know it's a bit messy, but talking about a stipend, have you got your money from the VRC yet? Hasn't gone into accounts?
No.
How come they've taken an eternity now to fund us. Well, I mean, say if you win the race, the money should go in straight away, should it not?
Well, the prize money is $150,000. Weren't you telling me before any race over $100,000 they've got a...
What did I tell you about figures? Don't mention figures. This is not a secure line.
No, I'm not talking about...
This is not a secure line.
I'm talking about the structure and the VRC.
I know. Everything over 100,
they
swab the horse and they go through the process and all the paraphernalia they go through. And then they have a look at its ownership, which will probably delay it.
That's a worry.
Anyhow, we've got one of the most prominent of Australians online you could ever imagine.
Well, it's interesting about this guy because, you know, we take it for granted. We talk about racing and people are going to Flemington for the carnival and Corfu and anywhere else. They're all curators. They've got people look after the grass and the ground and the... And they're tested and they're criticised. We've got all the footy grounds. We've got people mowing lawns that call themselves curators.
Yeah.
But the doyen is Les Burdett from the South Australian Cricket Association. In fact, he was there for 40 years.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Now, you know this bloke, I don't.
I know him personally, and what a great bloke he is, well, and a very humorous guy and a great orator.
Well, say good morning to him.
Well, good morning, Mr. Burdett.
Hello, Samuel.
How are you, mate?
Very well, thanks, buddy, and good morning, Leon.
Good morning, Les. Who called you the pitch whisperer, the pitch whisperer?
Somebody in the media, mate. It made a headline once, and, yeah, I've been called silly.
I must say, it's one thing I must remember not to try and say, pitch whisperer, if I remember tested for 05. So
not to be confused, Leon, with the horse whisperer. It's one of the great shows.
That's right. Les, it's a huge career you had at South Australia, and let's go through the process. You got there in 1969. What were you doing?
You've done before? Some research, Leon, have you?
Oh, that's about it.
Oh, I'm, story I'm, of his life.
The bucket.
Part of his Fitzroy Football Club. You read the history of that.
Very quickly.
I'm going to a reunion for Fitzroy on Sunday, on Saturday.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, the amateurs, where they're playing, on the Fitzroy's
that's
name.
That's right.
And, so, yeah.
Your big function.
Yeah, that's right. Sponge they do. They fill it up. Les, what were you doing before 69?
School and sort of working out what I was going to do. It's a bit hard to get work around the late 60s and guys were getting put off around the place. So I was going to be a plumber of all things. And then my dad was a builder and I learnt that Arthur Lance was looking for a young buck. So I went on probation for 9 months and it was an opportunity for him to sack me or for me to get out of there if I didn't like it. But from the day I walked on there, I was walking in his footsteps. And I'm one of seven boys, and he was just like a second dad to me. He was just a beautiful human being. And then I went off and did Nasho, did 18 months in the army, and that taught me a lot of those other valuable things in life like respect that can be missing around the place nowadays. But respect for chain of command, yourself, your mates alongside you, your equipment. And with that, I went back to Adelaide Oval and did horticulture at an Oubre College. And, yeah, it was after that, Arthur had a heart attack. And by the age of 27, I was running Adelaide Oval.
Les, I know a lot of curators. I've been to a lot of ovals around the world. And, look, if you asked me to name one of them, I couldn't even think of one. But Les Burdett, you're almost up there like Broadway in bright lights. You know, you talk about curators and mention the Adelaide Oval. They don't mention Chapel or the Richardsons or Bradman. They mention Les Burdett. So how come all of a sudden you become this great phenomena? How does one become so ingrained into the culture of a groundsman? To become a groundsman, what did you become? What were you, a failed cricketer, or what were you?
Well, I certainly would have liked to have played more cricket than I did, but I was always working weekends, and it's one of those things that one of my biggest disappointments really is not playing cricket at the high level. But I won a Australian rules football game on Adelaide Oval for the amateur league, and that was pretty terrific to run on your own turf, but. It's the thing that I found, Sam and Leon, was every time a touring side would come to Adelaide, I'd go out of my way to welcome them, greet them, and explain prevailing conditions. Not to make excuses, but just to tell them what the weather pattern has been before and the amount of traffic we've had, et cetera, et cetera. Just so you get a little bit of credibility with the players. And with that, I've got, I'm just so fortunate to name a whole heap of them as mates.
But your profile as a curator, I mean to say, we talk about cricket, we talk about Adelaide, the first name that's ever mentioned is Les Burdett. What about those pictures he's, made? The pictures have been, so user-friendly to both bat and bowler, and it's a special and unique piece of work. You know, how did all that evolve? How did it evolve? You didn't self-promote because I know you too well, but it's one of the great mysteries of the world to me.
Sammy, you know, I think it might have started a little bit too with Barry Gibbs, was the CEO of Sacca at Adelaide Oval, and he was on my, we've lost him now, but he was on my hand of five of best mates. And when he retired, he asked me if I would make sure that Daphne Benno, Richie's wife, got two members' tickets. So I made sure that Daphne Benno got two members' tickets to get into Adelaide Oval Test Match. And with that, I sort of got on the right side of Richie Benno, who I believe to be the doyen of the lot of them. When Richie spoke, it was worth listening to because he thought out the process and everything he said regarding the game, I thought, was just first class. So Richie became a bit of a supporter, I guess, and I don't think I ever heard him say anything derogatory about me, and he was always pumping my tyres up. So I've got a lot to thank in Richie Benno.
We can talk about Barry, about Richie Benno all day, but Barry Gibbs is one of those forgotten blokes, and he actually was a member of our Vang Sang Club here in Victoria, and spent a lot of time in Queensland as well. So, just a very, very good administrator.
Oh, he was just a bloody good bloke and knew his stuff. And he knew how to treat people. He was just, one of the things I said at his funeral was it was a gentle man, but he was a gentle person. He was just a lovely human being.
Now, Les, one of the great controversials of cricket has always been the pitch.
Yep.
You know, and, you know, is it, you know, has it been doctored and how can, have you watered it, or is it favour the batsman, or is it a feather bed, or is it a green top? What was your MO in terms of creating the right pitch? Say for international tour, you know that we've got a blistering opening pace attack, or the West Indies have got a pace attack. Did it ever enter your mind that you might be sort of more prone to delivering a user-friendly batting pitch for the Australian bats, as opposed to you know, helping the Windies quicks?
Sam, in my capacity, and still am, as pitch advisor for Cricket Australia, and I've travelled the countryside and several stints overseas doing consultancies and working, always in my back of mind is the player's safety. And when I look at player's safety, I mean they've got to come to work as a cricketer and know they're in a safe workplace. So I always erred on slightly dry and made the best team win. I've also of the belief that if you were to contrive a cricket pitch, be that green and seeming and damp, or dry as a Bunsen burner, you're turning the game. And if you do it for South Australia or Australia, in my situation, and we lose the toss, all of that is negated. Right. And then everybody wants to stick a knife in your back. So I just tell the curators that I meet around the countryside is always stay true to yourself. The game's more important. Just make it sporting so the ball does bounce and carry so the players can play their shots. And to achieve that, you need a good climate. You need a good soil type in the clay that's chosen. You need a good grass cover. You need everything to look like a billiard table when you finish and you walked off. So it's all putting all those ingredients into that cake, so the cake's in the right time in the oven, so it's not overcooked or underdone. So I just prided myself on one. I'd always listen to the captain and the players, never be with them after in the rooms and find out what's going on inside their heads and find out what their expectation of a cricket pitch was, and from that formulate your own methodology so you make sure you're doing the right thing by the game and not being a cheat.
Les, look, we admire your ethics, and, of course, your level of expertise has been sought, as you said, all overseas. Well, tell me one thing. I find one of the great mysteries of the cricketing world, the subcontinent. How come they can always, somehow create a good spinning track. Why can't you get them to put a bit of grass in the turf?
I think just recently we experienced all that. And what you've got to remember too, India, of all the money in world cricket, India have 80% of the total money.
That's right.
So there's a lot of money that drives around, drives India. And I spoke at before the IPL started back in 2006. I went up there and ran a two-day seminar up in the Punjab. And during that period, I spoke to eight guys that were the managers of their facilities, and they were terrific blokes. And I went up with Toro, and we sold they bought $2 million worth of equipment for their cricket pitches and ovals. And the eight people that purchased them were around the table. Anyway, I did my presentation on cricket pitches and construction, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of it, one guy said to me, he says, "Les," he said, "if we would all like to do it the way you manage your ground by building a cricket pitch that is sporting and good for the game, but we're told by our captains, our coaches, our presidents, our secretaries, our
everyone,
we've
got to win the game,
what we should be doing. And if we don't do it, we're not working." So to me, it was just sad and frustrating, but that's the way it is. And if that's the way they want to play it, so be that. Who am I to tell them anything different? But it's certainly not the way I'd conduct myself.
Now, Les, I assume you're an Adelaide bloke, born and bred?
And I'm in love with the place.
Well, you'd be more in love with the new Adelaide Oval, I guess, would you? It's a wonderful stadium.
Oh, look, I used to compare ground in England called Worcester and the one down in Cape Town to Adelaide Oval, the prettiest grounds in the world. Well, I've been to them all and checked them all out, and call me biased, but even before the $535 million development of Adelaide Oval in 2012, it was the most picturesque ground. It's still even now, Leon, when you walk in the ground, and it's not just plastic seats and concrete and bricks. You've got the open end, you've got the hill, you've got the old scoreboard built in 1911 for £1,235. And you can walk in there and look at that scoreboard, and you know what's going on with the game, because it's all there for you, who took the wickets and who's out and for how many. It's just the most unique, beautiful place in the world. And the Oval used to have a fall of 5'6" across it, as Lord's has a fall of 9 feet from the northern end to the southern end. And when they reconstructed recently, they left that 9 foot fall at Lord's. But when we built the Western grandstands at Adelaide Oval in this new development, the decision was made to flatten the ground so it is flat, like the MCG is flat, and put a drainage system in it that would tolerate 6 inches or 150 millimetres an hour. So, and being flat, you can play any sport you like, from international soccer to, athletics, whatever. So it makes it a multi-purpose facility by being flat, and it's still the most picturesque ground in the world.
Les, you made a fleeting reference to the scoreboard, which is very unique, built in 1920, whatever it was, for £1,000 or something.
Very unique.
It was very unique.
No, just unique.
Just unique. Okay, pardon that I get chipped every now and again. The scoreboard, what are some of the fond memories you have of it, Les? Did you not rearrange it once and declare your love for your beautiful wife?
Are
you there?
Few stories that go on within the scoreboard, which aren't for radio. But I know I did have a mate that he worked at SAC and I was his best man. And when he passed away, he wanted to be put on the Oval. So I got a 2-inch auger and went up in front of the scoreboard. And I got him halfway, right in the middle of the scoreboard, and put in 8 holes because his favourite number was 8, and his wife and my wife and a couple other couples were there, and we put his ashes down there. So when I go to the cricket, I normally go for a walk over there and stand where I know he is laying and say hello and have a beer for him, a West End draft, of course. And, the scoreboard is unique. No.
But you also declared your love for your lovely wife, Belinda, too, did you not?
Jane,
sorry, Jane, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Jay Irons, sorry.
Missed by a rat, though.
I was engaged to a Belinda, so you probably got
that. I knew.
That hasn't continued, has it, Les, on the side?
No, that's
I think we'll delete that from the transcript, Les. They've been looking for a few blokes. They've been looking for a few blokes lately. It's not the climate to be caught playing around, you know.
No, I know.
God, you make it hard for the normal bloke, Les.
Les, of all the captains you spoke to, and that was interesting to hear you say that you spent time with the players and the captains and got their opinions, but who are the ones you admired the most over the journey? You'd go back to Les Favelle? No, you wouldn't. But
yeah, no, Les Favelle was doing it.
Yeah, those sort of guys. Yeah. So
yeah, then Ian Chappell took over.
Yeah, okay. So name a couple of the ones that perhaps were more interesting than the others, or that you enjoyed probably.
David Hooks.
David Hooks. I mean, on the 18th of January 2004, outside a pub in St Kilda, some moron belted in from behind and cracked his skull on the gutter. I got involved with the protocol department here in Adelaide, and whether they're going to have Hooksy's funeral at the MCG, the cathedral here in Adelaide or Adelaide Oval, and we decided that bring him back home. So, yeah.
Shocking night.
The passing of Hooksy was, I recall laying a wreath of flowers as I kept the stumps when he played his last game, the six stumps. I had plaques put on them. I gave three to Hooksy. Barry Gibbs had one, I had one, and Saka had one. Well, I grabbed those three and I stood them where Hooksy stood, and I lent his Hooks hurricane bat against the stumps, and I hung his state cap on the stumps, as he used to do when he walked off at drinks time or tea or for a drink. He'd lean his bat on the stumps and he'd put his cap on there to dry. And so I made that statement and marked the pitch out, because it was the day after One Day International. And I remember 3OW rang me and says, Les, what just went through your mind? Because it was a private moment with a wreath of roses for Hooksy. And I said my personal farewell. And they said, what's going through your mind? I said, look, I've never seen so many guys hug and cry as I have in the last couple of weeks since Hooksy's passing. I said, I was only 18 when I lost my mum back in 1970. And the devastation that had me, the effect that was on me. And I felt something similar with the loss of Hooksy. So, and it still does to a degree. He would have been 69 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, it was a tragic moment in time. Les, tell me, you've certainly moved on and you've diversified as well. I see you bought out a product called Lawn Food. you've certainly learned how to commercialise your and leverage off your wonderful work.
Yeah, Sam. At one stage, I was part of a West End promotion here in Adelaide, and had my face on billboards at the airport and around the town, and ads on TV. And I became the West End beer drinker. and when I retired, a wine company asked me to be an ambassador for the wine company in Hazelgrove here in Adelaide, and I had to try the product first, and it is a good product, so I'm an ambassador for a Hazelgrove winery. But you really made it when you get your face put on a bag of shit. I mean, I'm really up there now. Bag of fertiliser, and my face is written all over this bag of fertiliser. So I'm really made it now.
Self-deprecation, it's a wonderful thing. It's a pity Australia wouldn't take it on board today. God.
Yeah.
When in actual fact we have turned to shit. But anyhow.
You're on Sport and Life, and our guest today is Les Burnett, and he's long-term curator. You prefer the word curator rather than greenkeeper?
Golf courses are superintendents. My portfolio was not just the cricket pitch, it was the facility as well. So I was the oval manager. But at the end of the day, my main focus was the performance of the cricket pitch out the middle. I'd start with that and work my way away from it.
And the other thing, Les, you've always made reference to, which is, a very humbling part of your upbringing, I guess. But you've always heaped a lot of praise on the team. You know, I mean, so you were the delegator and you were the boss in charge. Everyone knew that. But you also delegated your team very well, and you heaped a lot of praise on your staff.
Yeah, Sam, you're only as good as the people around you. I mean, you know, even peer groups with young kids now, if they get stuck with the wrong kids growing up, they sort of tend to go the wrong way. So it's so important to have good people around you. So, yeah, when I'd set a game plan for even when I do interstate stuff down, I walk on somebody else's ground, the first thing you do is build a relationship with that bloke. And you don't tell them what to do. You try to manoeuvre them to a degree where you set a game plan together and they take ownership of it. But, I'm a team player, always been a team player. One of seven boys, so I had to pull my weight in the family as well when I was a kid.
Cool.
So I think it's a no-brainer. And my dear old mum taught me that if you do unto others the way that you want others to do unto you was a very simple philosophy.
Yes, well, perhaps I'll get Sam to write that down and look at it regularly.
I tell you what, Leon, I'm sensitive. There's a limit to how many bashings I can take.
Les, the Australian Cricket Academy's been over there for many, many years now. Do they ever come to the South Australian Oval and the Adelaide Oval, rather, and train there? Or what are the facilities like?
You're talking about the Cricket Academy?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Cricket Academy left a few years ago, and we had them for 15 years and worked very well. And during that period, on my ground staff was Ricky Ponting while they were at the Academy. When Rod Marsh was boss of the Academy, he made sure the kids trained in the morning, went to jobs during the day, and then trained at the night time, didn't sit on their bums. So I had Mitch Johnson on my ground staff, Haddon, Ian Harvey. There was a whole heap of guys that came through and on the ground staff during that period of time, and they shifted up chasing the weather because in Queensland there's no two ways about it. You can play cricket all year round up there, whereas you've got to put up the winter months here in Adelaide.
Yeah, the other thing about the people who look after cricket grounds, the most controversial, interesting, whatever you want to call him, was a bloke named Clem Jones up in Queensland.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did you know, you know of him, of course, but did
I knew of him. He was, wasn't he a clerk or
he's the Lord Mayor of Brisbane. Yeah. And the Lord Mayor of Brisbane, that's bigger than Adelaide and Melbourne put together. They look after all the suburbs, the whole lot.
Yeah.
So it's a big job. But he used to look after the ground too.
Yeah, it was a good model too. I reckon most should have done the same thing. But he helped after the Cyclone Tracy, didn't he, up in Darwin?
He did. Yeah. He was. Tommy, Les, you haven't been without your own personal battles as well. You know, you had a bout with cancer, which, thank God, you beat. You're in... You're comfortable with that, but that must have also set you back a little bit.
That's probably the reason I retired. I had a bit of a scare in December of 2009, and I had a biopsy done, and I got an all clear on my prostate. And but I figured something was brewing. Pardon me. Something was brewing, so. Things were changing in Adelaide Oval, and I thought, well, maybe it's time just to put the cue in the rack. I was 59 after 41 years, and I'm glad I did because the following year I did have my prostate removed. Fortunately, I got it early and removed it from my body, and that's now 2012, so that's now 12 years, and I've just got to put up with the manlyhood part of it all, but at least I'm alive. And I know lots of guys that went in denial and did not have it removed and tried other ways, and they're no longer with us.
Yeah, you're very well spoken. Les, as you look at the contemporary landscape of cricket, you know, and I guess it'd be fair to say that you'd be a traditionalist in that regard. Test cricket was the diet that we all grew up on, the one that we loved the most. But in contemporary times, we've been inundated with all these... you know, typically runs of Mickey Mouse cricket, but as you rightfully alluded to, The Indians have got 80% of the loot. They control the game in total. What do you make of cricket as we speak? Are you saddened with the long version of the game, the demise of it?
Yes, it's Sam. I'm very much a traditionalist, and give me a Pommy Aussie.
Yeah, test match can't beat them.
But when Packer came in the late 70s and decided this pajama game, well, it did bring a completely new a supporter to the game, and all of a sudden we had young kids following their heroes go back to Test cricket, and I guess it was to a degree maybe the saviour of Test cricket when you look back at it. But yeah, now the 2020 game took me a while to adjust to that, but as long as it's cricket, I'm pretty happy with it. And I must admit, just recently with the 50 over World Cup, that got me in again. So I've sort of been for and against and for. So I've been moving around a bit depending on, and the players that are playing too. And there's, you know, the Aussies have got such a strong team, and they're just bloody good at it.
Les, from a layman's perspective, just quickly, the difference between creating a one-day pitch as opposed to a five-day pitch.
Yep. For a test match, I always make sure it's almost playable at lunchtime the day before, so there's no seaming movement in it. If the pitch is too wet, as a test match at the MCG was for a boxing, where was it? There was a Boxing Day test match where the sun was out and you couldn't play for that first session because the pitch was too damp. There was just a bit of a stuff up there. Someone got it wrong. It became overcast and the pitch hadn't dried. So they lost that whole session. But it was the correct thing to do because they had time to roll it and get it hard again. Whereas there was a Sheffield Shield game on the MCG 5-6 years ago where they played on the wet one and they put Denzel over it. And when the sun came out, those little craters in the pitch dried and the ball was hitting them and knocking blokes' heads off.
Yeah.
So it's a fine line. If you get it wrong, you get it really wrong. So I just heard on slightly dry. So for a test match, basically you'd have it dry the day, lunchtime the day before and ready to go. And for a one day, you probably let it go for an extra day just so the surface is, so the ball is not going to bite into the clay that's holding it together.
Les, these days we've seen big money introduced to all facets of sport, but in particular the enormity of gambling in the game.
Yeah.
I guess at some stage, I don't know, would you have been approached to create a certain...
I used to have a guy from India ring me. And he'd ask me who's going to win the toss, and I'd say something stupid, and he'd ask what the weather's like, and I'd say it's rainy but fine. So it was just a bit of a joke around the place, and everyone tries to get a foot in the door, so to speak. But
they were good over there, weren't they? The Indians. What about when they? When they were betting ball by ball, and they said that there'd be a ball in the third ball or the second over, would be a no ball.
Yeah.
And it certainly was.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, in the Hartsey Cronje thing, I went to and did some work and met his dad, and then I met him over here. And the way that all played out by the police happened to be doctoring a bookmaker's phone in India and picked up some information. Yeah.
Very sad. Les, thanks a lot, mate. We could talk for eons, you know, so many interesting facets of your overall life, and you know, not only in, you know, in cricket in general, but the individual people associated with it. But we really do thank your time, and look forward to catching up the next West End drop that we had a couple of weeks ago, mate. I really enjoyed your company immensely.
No, you're a character, you're colourful, and you're a beautiful person, Sam. And you say it as it is, and what's wrong with that?
No, there's nothing wrong with that, mate. True to your heart.
Yeah.
The other thing is, Les, this might interest you. Because of our sponsor, well, a great friend, Jerry Ryan, who owns Mitchelton Winery as well, part of his portfolio, we give our guests always a couple of bottles of the finest wine I don't know what you prefer, whether it's red or white. And a bit like me the other day, what did we have? Basket press for about 3 hours. Didn't
yeah.
we? That was okay. So we give our guest always a couple of bottles. So Leon's in charge, unfortunately, of distributing them. And our first guest of 4 years ago is still waiting for his. So what I'm saying to you, don't be knocking. If you hear a knock on the door, it won't be the wine. All right. And by the way, go back to that scoreboard and adjust your wife's name and your girlfriend's name. All right.
Yeah, I've got that. Thanks, Sam. Thanks for that.
Les Burdett joining us on Sport and Life. Thanks, Les.
Cheers, Leon. Cheers, Sam.
See you, mate. Fantastic.